Remember how I said that Robert Johnson, during the Halloween episode, had, according to legend, has sold his soul to the devil to become like this really great blues guitarist? There's a similar legend revolving around Jimi Hendrix, that he sold his soul to the devil and he became a great guitarist. That's one that I've heard, and of course I don't believe it. But there are some parallels between them. They were both these amazing guitarists. They were both innovators, and often imitated, never duplicated, that kind of thing. Musical geniuses. But the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame describes him as the greatest instrumentalist in the history of rock music. He was born in Seattle, Washington, and he began playing guitar at age 15. In 1961, he enlisted in the U.S. Army and trained as a paratrooper in the 101st Airborne Division. But he was discharged the following year. He moved to Clarksville, Tennessee soon after and began playing gigs on the Chitlin Circuit, earning a place in the Isley Brothers backing band and later with Little Richard, with whom he continued to work through mid-1965. He played with Curtis Knight and the Squires before moving to England in late 1966 after being discovered by Linda Keith, who interested bassist Chaz Chandler of the Animals in becoming his first manager. Within months, Hendrix earned 3 UK top 10 hits with the Jimi Hendrix Experience. Yeah, I know, that sounds a little bit like the name of my project, the Paul Walker Experience. But pay that no mind. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The hits Hey Joe, Purple Haze, and The Wind Cries Mary. He achieved fame in the U.S. after his performance at the Monterey Pops Festival in 1967, and his third and final studio album, Electric Ladyland, reached number one in the U.S. in 1968. It was Hendrix's most commercially successful release and his only number one album. He was the world's highest paid performer, and he headlined the Woodstock Festival in 1969 and the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970. He died from barbiturate-laced asphyxia on September 18th, 1970, at age 27. By the way, there's this... have you ever heard of what they call the 27 Club? It's a group of mostly famous musicians who died at the age of 27, and that includes Robert Johnson, Jimi Hendrix, and some others like Kurt Cobain. There's quite a few people that have died at age 27. There's like been a couple of actors, but it's mostly musicians that this is noted for. And a lot of people, they even touched about this on this in, on the show Supernatural, the 27 Club. Basically, the legend is that all these people were making deals with the devil and that he'd come for them at age 27. And they kind of played that up on the TV show Supernatural. So there's that connection, It's one of those cultural things. Funny thing is, though, it's like a lot more famous singers actually die at the age of 56 than they do 27. A lot more. So I don't know why it is that age 27 is such a big deal. I guess it's something, I guess like 7 + 2 = 9, and there's 9 circles in hell. Maybe there's that. Maybe that's why that goes the way it does. He favored overdriven amplifiers with high volume and gain, and he was instrumental in popularizing the previously undesirable sounds caused by guitar amplifier feedback. One of the things that he was known for was he would go up to the amp, and he would play his guitar right into the amp to get like the feedback sounds he wanted. And one of the stories that I've heard about Jimi Hendrix is that he kept a notebook on feedback. He'd be in the studio by himself. He'd be jamming, playing around, and he'd be experimenting with the feedback, and he'd write down notes about how to get the desired effects that he wanted. I don't know how true that is, but it's just a legend that I've heard. And I could believe that, actually. I could see him doing that. I really could. He was also one of the first guitarists to make extensive use of tone-altering effect units in mainstream rock, such as fuzz tone, Octavia, Wah-Wah, and Univibe. He was the first musician to use stereophonic phasing effects in recordings. Holly George Warren of Rolling Stone writes, quote, Hendrix pioneered the use of the instrument as an electronic sound source. Players before him had experimented with feedback and distortion, but Hendrix turned those effects and others into a controlled, fluid vocabulary, every bit as personal as the blues with which he began. In 1967, readers of Melody Maker voted Hendrix Pop Musician of the Year, and Rolling Stone declared him the Performer of the Year in 1968. Disc and Music Echo magazine honored him with the World Top Musician of 1969, and Guitar Player named him the Rock Guitarist of the Year in 1970. The Jimi Hendrix Experience was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1992, and the UK Music Hall of Fame in 2005. Rolling Stone ranked the band's three studio albums among the 100 greatest albums of all time, and ranked Hendrix the greatest guitarist and sixth greatest artist of all time. So yeah, Kanye West, beat that, all right? Beat that. Then maybe I'll be embarrassed as hell if you can beat that, but until then, I'm not holding my breath. But as far as his ancestry and childhood goes, his Hendrix's paternal grandparents, Ross and Nora Hendrix, had a diverse heritage. His paternal grandmother, Nora Rose Moore, was African-American and one-quarter Cherokee. Hendrix's paternal grandfather, Bertrand Philander Ross Hendrix, born in 1866, was born out of an extramarital affair between a woman named Fanny and a grain merchant from Urbana, Ohio, or Illinois, one of the wealthiest men in the area at the time. After Hendrix and Moore relocated to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, they had a son named James Allen Hendrix on June 10, 1919. The family called him Al. In 1941, after moving to Seattle, Al met Lucille Jeter at a dance, and they married on March 31, 1942. Lucille's father, who was Jimmy's paternal grandfather, was Preston Jeter, and whose mother was born in similar circumstances as Bertrand Philander Ross Hendrix. Lucille's mother, Clarice Lawson, had African-American and Cherokee ancestors. Al, who had been drafted by the U.S. Army to serve in World War II, left to begin his basic training 3 days after the wedding. Johnny Allen Hendrix was born November 27, 1942 in Seattle. And he was the first of Lucille's five children. In 1946, Johnny's parents changed his name to James Marshall Hendrix, in honor of Al and his late brother Leon Marshall. Stationed in Alabama at the time of Hendrix's death, Al was denied the standard military furlough offered by servicemen for childbirth. Wow, that sucks. And his commanding officer placed him in the stockade to prevent him from going AWOL to see his infant son. Damn. That's heartbreaking. He spent 2 months locked up without trial, and wow, this is just getting worse. And while in stockade, received a telegram announcing his son's birth. During Al's 3-year absence, Lucille struggled to raise their son. When Al was away, Hendrix was mostly cared for by family members and friends, especially Lucille's sister Dolores Hall and her friend Dorothy Harding. Al received an honorable discharge from the U.S. Army on September 1, 1945. 2 months later, unable to find Lucille, Al went to the Berkeley, California home of a family friend named Mrs. Champ, who had taken care of and had attempted to adopt Hendrix. This is where Al saw his son for the first time. After returning from service, Al reunited with Lucille, but his inability to find steady work left the family impoverished. They both struggled with alcohol and often fought when intoxicated. The violence sometimes drove Hendrix to withdraw and hide in a closet at their home. His relationship with his brother Leon, born in 1948, was close but precarious. With Leon in and out of foster care, they lived with an almost constant threat of fraternal separation. In addition to Leon, Hendrix had three younger siblings, Joseph, born in 1949, Kathy in 1950, and Pamela in 1951, all of whom Al and Lucille gave up to foster care and adoption. Wow, this is a sad story I'm hearing here. It sounds like Jimi Hendrix had a lot to rebel against and probably had some bearing on... Turns out that, like, when he was drunk, he was kind of a mean drunk, but we'll get into that more later on. The family frequently moved, staying in cheap hotels and apartments around Seattle. On occasion, family members would take Hendrix to Vancouver to stay at his grandmother's. A shy and sensitive boy, he was deeply affected by his life experiences. Yeah, I can imagine. In later years, he confided to a girlfriend that he had been the victim of sexual abuse by a man in uniform. On December 17, 1951, when Hendrix was 9 years old, his parents divorced. The court granted Al custody of him and Leon. Ah, wow, that... Damn. Okay, enough of that. Enough of that sad tale. The first instruments that he played. At Horace Mann Elementary School in Seattle during the mid-1950s, Hendrix's habit of carrying a broom with him to emulate a guitar gained the attention of the school's social worker. After more than a year of his clinging to a broom like a security blanket, she wrote a letter requesting school funding intended for underprivileged children, insisting that leaving him without a guitar might result in psychological damage. Her efforts failed, and Al refused to buy him a guitar. In 1957, while helping his father with a side job, Hendrix found a ukulele amongst the garbage they were moving from an older woman's home. She told him that he could keep the instrument, which had only one string. Learning by ear, he played single notes, following along to Elvis Presley songs, particularly Hound Dog. By the age of 33, Hendrix's mother Lucille had developed cirrhosis of the liver, and on February 2, 1958, she died when her spleen ruptured. Al refused to take James and Leon to attend their mother's funeral. He instead gave them shots of whiskey and instructed them that that was how men should deal with loss. Wow. In 1958, Hendrix completed his studies at Washington Junior High School and began attending, but he did not graduate from Garfield High School. In mid-1958, at age 15, Hendrix acquired his first electric guitar for $5, which is equivalent to $43.40 in today's money. Yeah, wow. $5 was worth... had the purchasing power of $43 back then. Can you imagine that? He played for hours daily, watching others and learning from more experienced guitarists and listening to blues artists such as Muddy Waters, B.B. King, Howlin' Wolf, and Robert Johnson. Robert Johnson, the great guitarist who also died at age 27 and was a legend, was an influence on Jimi Hendrix. That's kind of cool, actually. That is really cool. I like that. The first tune Hendrix learned to play was the television theme Peter Gunn. Around that time, Hendrix jammed with a boyhood friend, Sammy Drain, and his keyboard-playing brother. In 1959, attending a concert by Hank Ballard and the Midnighters in Seattle, Hendrix met the group's guitarist, Billy Davis. Davis showed him some guitar licks and got him a short gig with the Midnighters. The two remained friends until Hendrix's death in 1970. Soon after he acquired the acoustic guitar, Hendrix formed his first band, the Velvetones. Without an electric guitar, he could barely be heard over the sound of the group. After about 3 months, he realized that he needed an electric guitar. In mid-1959, his father relented and bought him a white Supro Ozark. I've never even heard of that brand, to be honest, but maybe some of you guitar players out there have heard of that brand and know what I'm talking about better than I do. Hendrix's first gig was with an unnamed band in the Jaffe Room of Seattle's Temple de Hirsch Sinai, but they fired him between sets for showing off. He joined the Rocking Kings, which played professionally at venues such as the Birdland Club. When his guitar was stolen after he left it backstage overnight, Al bought him a red Silvertone Dan Electro. And, of course, as I mentioned before, he had military service. He was in the Army, 1961. Before Hendrix was 19 years old, law authorities had twice caught him riding in stolen cars. Given a choice between prison or joining the Army, he chose the latter and enlisted on May 31, 1961. After completing 8 weeks of basic training at Fort Ord, California, he was assigned to the 101st Airborne Division and stationed at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He arrived on November 8th, and soon afterward he wrote to his father, quote, There's nothing but physical training and harassment here for 2 weeks. Then when you get to jump school, you get hell. They work you to death, fussing and fighting," end quote. In his next letter home, Hendrix, who had left his guitar at his girlfriend Betty Jean Morgan's house in Seattle, asked his father to send it to him as soon as possible, stating, "I really need it now." His father obliged and sent the red silver-toned Dan Electro in which Hendrix had hand-painted the words "Betty Jean" to Fort Campbell. His apparent obsession with the instrument contributed to his neglect of his duties, which led to taunting and physical abuse from his peers, who at least once hid the guitar from him until he had begged for its return. In November 1961, fellow serviceman Billy Cox walked past an army club and heard Hendrix playing. Impressed by Hendrix's technique, which Cox described as a combination of John Lee Hooker and Beethoven, Cox borrowed a bass guitar and the two jammed. Within weeks, they began performing at bass clubs on the weekends with other musicians in a loosely organized band, the Casuals. Hendrix completed his paratrooper training in just over 8 months, and Major General C.W.G. Rich awarded him the prestigious Screaming Eagles patch on January 11, 1962. By February, his personal conduct had begun to draw criticism from his superiors. They labeled him an unqualified marksman and often caught him napping while on duty and failing to report for bed checks. On May 24th, Hendrix's platoon sergeant, James C. Spears, filed a report in which he stated, "He has no interest whatsoever in the Army. It is my opinion that Private Hendrix will never come up to the standards required of a soldier. I feel that the military service will benefit if he is discharged as soon as possible," end quote. Damn, that's harsh, but probably true. I bet you Hendrix did not. I don't really think he liked the Army. He only went there because it was Army or jail, and he was just choosing the lesser of two evils. On June 29, 1962, Hendrix was granted a discharge under honorable conditions. Hendrix later spoke of his dislike of the Army and lied that he had received a medical discharge after breaking his ankle during his 26th parachute jump. And there's, of course, the matter of his career and in the early years. In September 1963, after Cox was discharged from the Army, he and Hendrix moved about 20 miles across the state line from Fort Campbell to Clarksville, Tennessee, and performed in a band, the King Casuals. In Seattle, Hendrix saw Butch Snipes play with his teeth, and now the Casuals' second guitarist, Alfonso Baby Boo Young, was performing this guitar gimmick. Not to be upstage, Hendrix also learned to play this way. He later explained, "The idea of doing that came to me in Tennessee. Down there, you have to play with your teeth or else you get shot. There's a trail of broken teeth all over the stage," end quote. Although they began playing low-paying gigs at obscure venues, the band eventually moved to Nashville's Jefferson Street, which was the traditional heart of the city's black community and home to a thriving rhythm and blues music scene. They earned a brief residency playing at a popular venue in town, the Club Del Morocco, and for the next 2 years, Hendrix made a living performing at a circuit of venues throughout the South that were affiliated with the Theater Owners Booking Association, widely known as the Chitlin' Circuit. In addition to playing in his own band, Hendrix performed as a backing musician for various soul, R&B, and blues musicians, including Wilson Pickett, Slim Harpo, Sam Cooke, Ike and Tina Turner, and Jackie Wilson. Ike and Tina Turner. Tina Turner is probably somebody else I'm going to have to talk about on this podcast one day. In January 1964, feeling he had outgrown the circuit artistically and frustrated by having to follow the rules of band leaders, Hendrix decided to venture out on his own. He moved into the Hotel Teresa in Harlem, where he befriended, this is going to be a hard name for me to pronounce, Lithophane Pridgen, known as Faye, who became his girlfriend. A Harlem native with connections throughout the area's music scene, Pridgen provided him with shelter, support, and encouragement. Hendrix also met the Allen twins, Arthur and Albert. In February 1964, Hendrix won first prize in the Apollo Theater Amateur Contest. Hoping to secure a career opportunity, he played the Harlem club circuit and sat in with various bands. At the recommendation of a former associate of Joe Tex, Ronnie Isley, granted Hendrix an audition that led to an offer to become the guitarist with the Isley Brothers backup band, the IB Specials, which he readily accepted. some of his first recordings. In March 1964, Hendrix recorded the two-part single Testify with the Isley Brothers. Released in June, it failed to chart. In May, he provided guitar instrumentation for the Don Covey song Mercy Mercy. Issued in August by Rosemart Records and distributed by Atlantic, the track reached number 35 on the Billboard chart. Hendrix toured with the Isleys during much of 1964, but near the end of October, after growing tired of playing the same set every night, he left the band. Soon afterward, Hendrix joined Little Richard's touring band, the Upsetters. During a stop in Los Angeles in February 1965, he recorded his first and only single with Richard, I Don't Know What You Got, But It's Got Me, written by Don Covey and released by VJ Records. Richard's popularity was waning at the time, and the single peaked at number 92, where it remained for 1 week before dropping off the chart. Hendrix met singer Rosalie Brooks while staying at the Wilcox Hotel in Hollywood, and she invited him to participate in a recording session for her single, which included the Arthur Lee penned My Diary as the A-side and Uti as the B-side. Hendrix played guitar on both tracks, which also included background vocals by Lee. The single failed to chart, but Hendrix and Lee began a friendship that lasted several years. Hendrix later became an ardent supporter of Lee's band, Love. In July 1965, on Nashville's Channel 5 Night Train, Hendrix made his first television performance. Performing Little Richard's ensemble band, he backed up vocalist Buddy and Stacy on Shotgun. The video recording of the show marks the earliest known footage of Hendrix performing. Richard and Hendrix often clashed over tardiness, wardrobe, and Hendrix's stage antics, and in late July, Richard's brother Robert fired him. He then briefly rejoined the Isley Brothers and recorded a second single with them, Move Over and Let Me Dance, backed with Have You Ever Been Disappointed? Later that year, he joined a New York-based R&B band, Curtis Knight and the Squires, after meeting Knight in the lobby of a hotel where both men were staying. Hendrix performed with them for 8 months. In October 1965, he and Knight recorded the single How Would You Feel, backed with Welcome Home. And on October 15th, Hendrix signed a 3-year recording contract with entrepreneur Ed Chalpin. While the relationship with Chalpin was short-lived, his contract remained in force, which later caused legal and career problems for Hendrix. During his time with Knight, Hendrix briefly toured with Joey D and the Starlighters and worked with King Curtis on several recordings, including Ray Sharp's two-part single, Help Me. Hendrix earned his first composer credits for two instrumentals, Hornet's Nest and Knock Yourself Out, released as a Curtis Knight and the Squire single in 1966. Feeling restricted by his experiences as an R&B sideman, Hendrix moved in 1966 to New York City's Greenwich Village, which had a vibrant and diverse music scene. There he was offered a residency at the Café Wa and on McDougal Street, and formed his own band that June, Jimmy James and the Blue Flames, which included future Spirit guitarist Randy California. The Blue Flames played at several clubs in New York, and Hendrix began developing his guitar style and material that he would soon use with the experience. In September, they gave some of their last concerts at the Café Ogogo as John Hammond Jr.'s backing group. Then after that came his band, the Jimi Hendrix Experience. By May 1966, Hendrix was struggling to earn a living wage playing the R&B circuit, so he briefly rejoined Curtis Knight and the Squires for an engagement in one of New York City's most popular night spots, the Cheetah Club. During a performance, Linda Keith, the girlfriend of Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards, noticed Hendrix and was mesmerized, her words, by his playing. She invited him to join her for a drink, and the two became friends. While Hendrix was playing with Jimmy James and the Blue Flames, Keith recommended him to Stones manager Andrew Luge Oldham and producer Seymour Stein. They failed to see Hendrix's musical potential and rejected him. I bet they were kicking themselves for years afterwards. I would be. That's that's shooting yourself in the foot right there. Keith referred him to Chaz Chandler, who was leaving the Animals and was interested in managing and producing artists. Chandler saw Hendrix play in Café Wa, a Greenwich Village, New York City nightclub. Chandler liked the Billy Roberts song Hey Joe and was convinced he could create a hit single with the right artist. Impressed with Hendrix's version of the song, he brought him to London on September 24, 1966, and signed him to a management and production contract with himself and ex-Animals manager Michael Jeffrey. On September 24th, Hendrix gave an impromptu solo performance at the Scotch of St. James, and later that night began a relationship with Kathy Etchingham that lasted for 2.5 years. Following Hendrix's arrival in London, Chandler began recruiting members for a band designed to highlight his talents, the Jimi Hendrix Experience. Hendrix met guitarist Noel Redding at an audition for the New Animals, where Redding's knowledge of blues progressions impressed Hendrix, who stated that he also liked Redding's hairstyle. Chandler asked Redding if he wanted to play bass guitar in Hendrix's band, and Redding agreed. Chandler began looking for a drummer and soon afterward contacted Mitch Mitchell through a mutual friend. Mitchell, who had recently been fired from Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames, participated in a rehearsal with Redding and Hendrix where they found common ground in their shared interest in rhythm and blues. When Chandler phoned Mitchell later that day to offer him the position, he readily accepted. Chandler also convinced Hendrix to change the spelling of his first name from J-I-M-M-Y to the more exotic Jimmy J-I-M-I. On October 1st, 1966, by the way, branding like that is as old as the hills, people. People talk about branding today like it's something new. No, it goes way back. On October 1st, 1966, Chandler brought Hendrix to the London Polytechnic at Regent Street, where Cream was scheduled to perform, and where Hendrix and guitarist Eric Clapton met. Clapton later said, "He asked if he could play a couple of numbers, and I said, of course, but I had a funny feeling about him," unquote. Halfway through Cream's set, Hendrix took the stage and performed a frantic version of the Howlin' Wolf song Killing Floor. In 1989, Clapton described the performance, "He played just about every style you could think of, and not in a flashy way. I mean, he did a few of his tricks like playing with his teeth and behind his back, but it wasn't in an upstaging sense at all. And that was it. He walked off and my life was never the same again." And Jimi Hendrix had some UK success. In mid-October 1966, Chandler arranged an engagement for the Experience at Johnny Holiday's as Johnny Holiday's supporting act during a brief tour of France. Thus, the Jimi Hendrix Experience performed their very first show on October 13, 1966, at the Novelty in Evreux. That's a French word. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. Hold on, there was a bit of a technical glitch there, and my wife called me, and the phone cut everything out, so hold on, I'm recording this on my phone. Let me find my place where I was in my notes. I was saying something about Evreux, which is a French word, and I don't know if I pronounced that right. Yes, this is one of the pitfalls of having to record a podcast on your phone. Sometimes people just interrupt you. Yeah, but and everything cut my notes out. I have my notes on my phone too, so. So, let's see, where is that? Okay, thus the Jimi Hendrix Experience performed their very first show on October 13, 1966 at the Novelty in Evreux. Their enthusiastically received 15-minute performance at the Olympia Theater in Paris on October 18th marks the earliest known recording of the band. In late October, Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp, managers of The Who, yes, that Who, signed the Experience to their newly formed label Track Records. And the group recorded their first song, Hey Joe, on October 23rd. Stone Free, which was Hendrix's first songwriting effort after arriving in England, was recorded on November 2nd. In mid-November, they performed at the Bag of Nails nightclub in London with Clapton, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Jeff Beck, Pete Townsend, Brian Jones, Mick Jagger, and Kevin Ayers in attendance. Ayers described the crowd's reaction as stunned disbelief. Quote, all the stars were there, and I heard serious comments, you know, shit, Jesus, damn, and other words worse than that. The performance earned Hendrix his first interview, published in Record Mirror, with the headline, Mr. Phenomenon. Quote, now hear this, we predict that Hendrix is going to whirl around the business like a tornado, end quote, wrote Bill Harry, who asked the rhetorical question, is that full big swinging sound really being created by only three people? Hendrix said, we don't want to be classed in any category. If it must have a tag, I'd like it to be called Free Feeling. It's a mixture of rock, freak out, rave, and blues, end quote. Through a distribution deal with Polydor Records, the Experience's first single, Hey Joe, back with Stone Free, was released on December 16, 1966. After appearances on the UK television shows Ready, Steady, Go and Top of the Pops, Hey Joe entered the UK charts on December 29th and peaked at number 6. Further success came in March 1967 with a UK number 3 hit, Purple Haze, and in May with The Wind Cries Mary, which remained on the UK charts for 11 weeks, peaking at number 6. On March 12, 1967, he performed at the Troutbeck Hotel in Ilkley, West Yorkshire, where, after about 900 people turned up, by the way, the hotel was licensed for 250, the local police stopped the gig due to safety concerns. On March 31st, 1967, while the Experience awaited to perform at the London Astoria, Hendrix and Chandler discussed ways in which they could increase the band's media exposure. When Chandler asked journalist Keith Atham for advice, Keith Aldham for advice, Aldham suggested that they needed to do something more dramatic than the stage show of The Who, which involved the smashing of instruments. Hendrix joked, maybe I can smash up an elephant, to which Aldham replied, well, it's a pity you can't set fire to your guitar. Oh, yes. It's a pity you can't set fire to your guitar. Chandler then, by the way, that was a bit of foreshadowing there. Chandler then asked road manager Jerry Stickles to procure some lighter fluid. During the show, Hendrix gave an especially dynamic performance before setting his guitar on fire at the end of a 45-minute set. In the wake of the stunt, members of London's press labeled Hendrix the Black Elvis and the Wild Man of Borneo. And I think there is, you know what, we'll wait for the sponsor segment. I'm gonna talk about the record Are You Experienced? After the UK chart success of their first two singles, Hey Joe and Purple Haze, the Experience began assembling material for a full-length LP. Recording began at D. Lane Leah Studios and later moved to the prestigious Olympic Studios. The album Are You Experienced features a diversity of musical styles, including blues tracks such as Red House and Highway Chile, and the R&B song Remember. It also included the experimental science fiction piece Third Stone from the Sun and the postmodern soundscapes of the title track, with prominent backwards guitar and drums. I Don't Live Today served as a medium for Hendrix's guitar feedback improvisation, and Fire was driven by Mitchell's drumming.
Hey, keep it down!
Sorry, I don't have a studio. I'm recording this in a bedroom, so sometimes my family makes noises. Released in the UK on May 12, 1967, Are You Experienced spent 33 weeks on the charts, peaking at number 2. It was prevented from reaching the top spot by the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And on June 4th, 1967, Hendrix opened a show at the Seville Theatre in London with his rendition of Sgt. Pepper's title track, which was released just 3 days previous. Beatles manager Brian Epstein owned the Seville at the time, and both George Harrison and Paul McCartney attended the performance. McCartney described the moment, "The curtains flew back, and he came walking forward playing Sgt. Pepper. It's a pretty major compliment in anyone's book. I put that down as one of the great honors of my career," end quote. Released in the U.S. on August 23rd by Reprise Records, Are You Experienced reached number 5 on the Billboard 200. In 1989, Noe Goldwasser, the founding editor of Guitar World magazine, described Are You Experienced as the album that shook the world, leaving it forever changed. In 2005, Rolling Stone called the double platinum LP Hendrix's epochal debut, and they ranked it in the 15th greatest album of all time, noting his exploitation of Amphal and characterizing his guitar playing as incendiary, historic in itself. Then there was the Monterey Pop Festival, and there's an iconic picture of Jimi Hendrix setting his guitar on fire and coaxing the flames higher with gestures of his fingers, suggestive of some sort of voodoo ritual almost. But author Michael Heatley wrote, "The iconic image of by Ed Carriff at Hendrix summoning the flames higher with his fingers will forever conjure up memories of Monterey for those who were there and the majority of us who weren't. Although popular in Europe at the time, the experience's first U.S. single, Hey Joe, failed to reach the Billboard Hot 100 chart upon its release in May 1, 1967. The group's fortunes improved when McCartney recommended them to the organizers of the Monterey Pop Festival. He insisted that the event would be incomplete without Hendrix, whom he called an absolute ace on the guitar," end quote. And he agreed to join the board of organizers on the condition that the experience perform at the festival in mid-June. On June 18, 1967, introduced by Brian Jones as the most exciting performer he had ever heard, end quote, Hendrix opened with a fast arrangement of Howlin' Wolf's song Killing Floor, wearing what author Keith Chadwick described as clothes as exotic as any on display elsewhere. Chadwick wrote, "Hendrix was not only something utterly new musically, but he was an entirely original vision of what a black American entertainer should and could look like," end quote. The experience went on to perform editions of Hey Joe, B.B. King's Rock Me Baby, Chip Taylor's Wild Thing, and Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone, as well as four original compositions, Foxy Lady, Can You See Me, The Wind Cries Mary, and Purple Haze. The set ended with Hendrix destroying his guitar and tossing pieces of it out into the audience. Rolling Stone's Alex Vatical wrote, "When Jimi Hendrix set his guitar on fire at the 1967 Monterey Pop Festival, he created one of rock's most perfect moments. Standing in the front row of that concert was a 17-year-old boy named Ed Carafe. Carafe had never seen Hendrix before nor heard his music, but he had a camera with him, and there was one shot left in his roll of film. As Hendrix lit his guitar, Carafe took a final photo. It would become one of the most famous images in rock and roll," end quote. Carafe stood on a chair next to the edge of the stage while taking a series of four monochrome pictures of Hendrix burning his guitar. Carafe was close enough to see the fire that he had to use his camera as a shield to protect his face from the heat. Rolling Stone later colorized the image, matching it with other pictures taken at the festival before using the shot for a 1987 magazine cover. According to author Gail Buckland, the fourth and final frame of Hendrix kneeling in front of his burning guitar, hand raised, is one of the most famous images in rock. Author and historian Matthew C. Whitaker wrote, "Hendrix's burning of his guitar became an iconic image in rock history and brought him national attention." The Los Angeles Times asserted that upon leaving the stage, Hendrix graduated from rumor to legend. Author John McDermott wrote that Hendrix left the Monterey audience stunned and in disbelief at what they just heard and seen. According to Hendrix himself, "I decided to destroy my guitar at the end of a song as a sacrifice. You sacrifice things you love, and I love my guitar." The performance was filmed by D.A. Pennebaker and later included in the concert documentary Monterey Pop, which helped Hendrix gain popularity with the U.S. public. Immediately after the festival, the experience was booked for a series of five concerts at Bill Graham's Fillmore with Big Brother and the Holding Company and Jefferson Airplane. The experience outperformed Jefferson Airplane during the first two nights and replaced them at the top of the bill in the fifth. Yeah, I can understand that. I'm not really a big fan of Jefferson Airplane, Jefferson Starship, They've been through a number of name changes. Personally, not a fan. Maybe you love them. Maybe you love Jefferson Airplane. More power to you if you do. I'm not going to tell you. You can like the thing you like. Don't listen to me. Following their successful West Coast introduction, which included a free open-air concert at Golden Gate Park and a concert at the Whiskey-A-Go-Go, The Experience was booked as the opening act for the first American tour of the Monkees. Remember the Monkees? Hey, we're the Monkees. Yeah, those Monkees. They requested Hendrix as a supporting act because they were fans, but their young audience disliked the Experience, who left the tour after six shows. Chandler later admitted that he engineered the tour in an effort to gain publicity for Hendrix. And I am going to do a sponsored segment because I got to try and make some money with this podcast. That way I would just love to be able to just do podcasts and make my own music and just quit my job. But I can't do that yet, so got to take that first step. So here comes a sponsored segment. And welcome back. Thanks for helping me pay the bills. Let me pull up my notes again here. These notes are a pain in the ass. They really are. I go to one window and everything else just resets on the other window. Don't you just hate it when that happens? Okay. We're going to talk about Axis, Bold as Love. Second Experience album, Axis, Bold as Love, opens with the track EXP, which utilized microphonic and harmonic feedbacks in a new creative fashion. It also showcased an experimental stereo panning effect, in which sounds emanating from Hendrix's guitar move through the stereo image, revolving around the listener. The piece reflected his growing interest in science fiction and outer space. He composed the album's title track and finale around two verses and two choruses, during which he pairs emotions with personas, comparing them to colors. The song's coda features the first recording of stereo phasing. Shadwick described the composition as possibly the most ambitious piece on Axis, the extravagant metaphors of the lyrics suggesting a growing confidence, end quote, in Hendrix's songwriting. His guitar playing throughout the song is marked by chordal arpeggios and contrapuntal motion, with tremolo-picked partial chords providing the musical foundation for the chorus, which culminates in what musicologist Andy Alidort described as simply one of the greatest electric guitar solos ever played. The track fades out on tremolo-picked 32nd note double stops. The scheduled release date for Axis was almost delayed when Hendrix lost the master tape of one side of the LP, leaving it in the back seat of a London taxi. Oh, damn, I would be freaking out. I'd be like, oh, God, no. With the deadline looming, Hendrix Chandler and engineer Eddie Kramer remixed most of a side one in a single overnight session, but they could not match the quality of the lost mix of If Six Was Nine. Bassist Noel Redding had a tape recording of this mix, which had to be smoothed out with an iron as it had gotten wrinkled. During the verses, Hendrix doubled his singing with a guitar line, which he played one octave lower than his vocals. Hendrix voiced his disappointment about having remixed the album so quickly, and he felt that it could have been better had they been given more time. Axis featured psychedelic cover art that depicts Hendrix in the Experience as various avatars of Vishnu, incorporating a painting of them by Roger Law from a photo portrait by Carl Ferris, excuse me. The painting was then superimposed on a copy of a mass-produced religious poster. Hendrix stated that the cover, which Track spent $5,000 producing, would have been more appropriate had it highlighted his American Indian heritage. He said, quote, "You got it wrong. I'm not that kind of Indian," unquote. Track released the album in the UK on December 1, 1967, where it peaked at number 5, spending 16 weeks on the charts. In February 1968, Axis Bold as Love reached the number 3 in the U.S. While author and journalist Richie Unterberger described Axis as the least impressive Experience album, according to author Peter Doggett, the release heralded a new subtlety in Hendrix's work, end quote. Mitchell said, "Axis was the first time that it became apparent that Jimmy was pretty good working behind the mixing board as well as playing, and had some positive ideas of how he wanted things recorded. It could have been the start of any potential conflict between him and Chaz in the studio. And let me see. There's something here in my notes that is just kind of confusing. Yeah, there's something that got in my notes that shouldn't be here. I am sorry, folks. I am trying to figure this out here. Yeah, my notes are all funky. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that is hard to read. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead to talking about the Cry of Love tour. I'm going to skip over some things because of technical difficulties with the notes. Soon after the abruptly ended Band of Gypsies performance and their subsequent dissolution, Jeffrey made arrangements to reunite the original Experience lineup. Yeah, there was this thing called the Band of Gypsies, which I skipped over. Sorry. Although Hendrix, Mitchell, and Redding were interviewed by Rolling Stone in February 1970 as a united group, Hendrix never intended to work with Redding. When Redding returned to New York in anticipation of rehearsals with a reformed Experience, he was told that he had been replaced with Cox. During an interview with Rolling Stone's Keith Albom, Hendrix defended the decision. "It's nothing personal against Noel, but we finished what we were doing with the Experience and Billy's style playing suits the new group better." Although an official name was never adopted for the lineup of Hendrix, Mitchell, and Cox, promoters often billed them as the Jimi Hendrix Experience or just Jimi Hendrix. During the first half of 1970, Hendrix sporadically worked on material for what would have been his next LP. Many of the tracks were posthumously released in 1971 as The Cry of Love. He had started writing songs for the album in 1968, but in April 1970, he told Keith Albom that the project had been abandoned. Soon afterward, he and his band took a break from recording and began the Cry of Love tour at the LA Forum, performing for 20,000 people. Set lists during the tour included numerous Experience tracks as well as a selection of newer material. Several shows were recorded, and they produced some of Hendrix's most memorable live performances. At one of them, the second Atlanta International Pop Festival on July 4th, he played to the largest American audience of his career. According to authors Scott Schindler and Annie Schwartz, as many as 500,000 people attended the concert. On July 17th, they appeared at the New York Pop Festival. Hendrix had again consumed too many drugs before the show, and the set was considered a disaster. Excuse me. The American leg of the tour, which included 32 performances, ended in Honolulu, Hawaii on August 1, 1970. This would be Hendrix's final concert appearance in the U.S. Then there was the thing with Electric Lady Studios. In 1968, Hendrix and Jeffrey jointly invested in the purchase of the Generation Club in Greenwich Village. They had initially planned to reopen the establishment, but when an audit of Hendrix's expenses revealed that he had incurred exorbitant fees by block booking recording studios for lengthy sessions at peak rates, they decided to convert the building into a studio of his own. Hendrix could then work as much as he wanted while also reducing his recording expenditures, which had reached a reported $300,000 annually. Architect and acoustician John Storick designed Electric Lady Studios for Hendrix, requested that they avoid right angles where possible. With round windows, an ambient lighting machine, and a psychedelic mural, Storick wanted the studio to have a relaxing environment that would encourage Hendrix's creativity. The project took twice as long as planned and cost twice as much as Hendrix and Jeffrey had budgeted, with their total investment estimated at $1 million. Hendrix first used Electric Lady on June 15, 1970, when he jammed with Steve Winwood and Chris Wood of Traffic. The next day, he recorded his first track there, Nightbird Flying. The studio officially opened for business on August 25th, and a grand opening party was held the following day. Immediately afterwards, Hendrix left for England. He never returned to the United States. He boarded an Air India flight for London with Cox, joining Mitchell for a performance as the headlining act of the Isle of Wight Festival. And from there, he went on to a European tour. When the European leg of the Cry of Love tour began, Hendrix was longing for his new studio and creative outlet. and was not eager to fulfill the commitment. On September 2, 1970, he abandoned a performance in Aarhus after three songs, stating, "I have been dead a long time." 4 days later, he gave his final concert appearance at the Isle of Femmarn Festival in Germany. I have trouble pronouncing some of these words, I'm sorry. He was met with booing and jeering from his fans in response to his cancellation of a show slated for the end of the previous night's bill due to torrential rain and risk of electrocution. Immediately following the festival, Hendrix, Mitchell, and Cox traveled to London. 3 days after the performance, Cox, who was suffering from severe paranoia after taking LSD or being given it unknowingly, quit the tour and went to stay with his parents in Pennsylvania. Within days of Hendrix's arrival in England, he had spoken with Chaz Chandler, Alan Douglas, and others about leaving his manager, Michael Jeffrey. On September 16th, Hendrix performed in public for the last time during an informal jam at Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club in Soho with Eric Burdon and his latest band, War. They began playing a few of their recent hits, and after a brief intermission, Hendrix joined them during Mother Earth and Tobacco Road. His performance was uncharacteristically subdued. He quietly played backing guitar and refrained from the histrionics that people had come to expect from him. He died less than 48 hours later. And as far as his drug use, Hendrix had entered a small club in Clarksville, Tennessee in July 1962, drawn in by live music. He stopped for a drink and ended up spending most of the $400 that he had saved during his time in the Army. "I went into this jazz joint and had a drink," he explained. "I liked it and I stayed. People tell me I get foolish, good-natured sometimes. Anyway, I guess I felt real benevolent that day. I must have been handing out bills to anyone that asked me. I came out of that place with $16 left." Alcohol eventually became, quote, "the scourge of his existence, driving him to fits of pique, even rare bursts of atypical physical violence," end quote. Like most acid heads, Jimmy had visions and he wanted to create music to express what he saw. He would try to explain this to people, but it didn't make any sense because it was not linked to reality in any way. Roby and Schreiber assert that Hendrix first used LSD when he met Linda Keith in late 1966. Shapiro and Glabeek, however, assert that Hendrix used it in June 1967 at the earliest while attending the Monterey Pop Festival. According to Hendrix biographer Charles Cross, the subject of drugs came up one evening in 1966 at Keith's New York apartment. One of Keith's friends offered Hendrix acid, a street name for LSD, but Hendrix asked for LSD instead, showing what Cross describes as his naivete and his complete inexperience with psychedelics. Before that, Hendrix had only sporadically used drugs, experimenting with cannabis, hashish, amphetamines, and occasionally cocaine. After 1967, he regularly used cannabis, hashish, LSD, and amphetamines, particularly while touring. According to Cross, few stars were as closely associated with the drug culture as Jimmy. Hendrix would often become angry and violent when he drank too much alcohol or when he mixed alcohol with drugs. His friend Herbie Worthington said that Hendrix simply turned into a bastard, end quote, when he drank. According to a friend, Sharon Lawrence, liquor set off a bottled-up anger, a destructive fury he almost never displayed otherwise. In January 1968, the experience traveled to Sweden for a one-week tour of Europe. During the early morning hours of the first day, Hendrix became engaged in a drunken brawl in the Hotel Opelin in Gothenburg, smashing a plate glass window and injuring his right hand, for which he received medical treatment. The incident culminated in his arrest and release pending a court appearance that resulted in a large fine. Hendrix was renting a house in Benedict Canyon in California in 1969 that was burglarized. He was later under the influence of drugs and alcohol, and he punched his friend Paul Caruso and accused him of the theft. He then chased Caruso away from the residence while throwing stones at him. A few days later, Hendrix's girlfriend, Carmen Barrero, required stitches after he hit her above her eye with a vodka bottle during a drunken, jealous rage. Hendrix was passing through customs at Toronto International Airport on May 3, 1969, when authorities found a small amount of heroin and hashish in his luggage. 4 hours later, he was formally charged with drug possession and released on $10,000 bail. He was required to return on May 5th for an arraignment hearing. The incident proved stressful for Hendricks, and it weighed heavily on his mind during the 7 months that he awaited trial, which took place in December 1969. For the Crown to prove possession, they had to show that Hendricks knew that the drugs were there. During the jury trial, he testified that a fan had given him a vial of what he thought was legal medication, which he put in his bag. He was acquitted of the charges. Mitchell and Redding were later revealed that everyone had been warned about a planned drug bust the day before flying to Toronto. Both men also stated that they believed that the drugs had been planted in Hendricks' bag without his knowledge. And finally, we come to the sad death of Jimi Hendricks at the Samarkand Hotel. Details are disputed concerning Hendricks' last day and death. He spent much of September 17, 1970, with Monica Daneman in London, the only witness to his final hours. Daneman said that she prepared a meal for them at her apartment in the Samarkand Hotel around 11 p.m., when they shared a bottle of wine. She drove him to the residence of an acquaintance at approximately 1:45 a.m., where he remained for about an hour before she picked him up and drove them back to her flat at 3 a.m. She said that they talked until around 7 a.m., when they went to sleep. She awoke around 11 a.m. and found Hendricks breathing but unconscious and unresponsive. She called for an ambulance at 11:18, which arrived at 11:27. Paramedics then transported Hendricks to St. Mary Abbott's Hospital, where Dr. John Bannister pronounced him dead at 12:45 on September 18th. Coroner Gavin Thurston ordered a post-mortem examination, which was performed on September 21 by Professor Donald Teer, a forensic pathologist. Thurston completed the inquest on September 28 and concluded that Hendricks aspirated on his own vomit and died of asphyxia while intoxicated with barbiturates. Citing insufficient evidence of the circumstances, he declared an open verdict. Daneman later revealed that Hendricks had taken 9 of her prescribed Vesprex sleeping tablets, 18 times the recommended dosage. Desmond Henley embalmed Hendricks' body, which was flown to Seattle on September 29, 1970. Hendricks' family and friends held a service at Dunlap Baptist Church in Seattle's Rainier Valley on October 1st. His body was interred at Greenwood Cemetery in Renton, Washington, the location of his mother's grave. Family and friends traveled in 24 limousines, and more than 200 people attended the funeral, including Mitch Mitchell, Noel Redding, Miles Davis, John Hammond, and Johnny Winter. But the story does not end there. After his death, there were some unauthorized and posthumous releases of his work and his material. By 1967, as Hendricks was gaining in popularity, many of his pre-experience recordings were marketed to an unsuspecting public as Jimi Hendrix albums, sometimes with misleading later images of Hendricks. The recordings, which came under the control of producer Ed Chalpin of PPX, with whom Hendricks had signed a recording contract in 1965, were often remixed between their repeated reissues and licensed to record companies such as Decca and Capitol. Hendricks publicly denounced the releases, describing them as malicious and greatly inferior, stating that, "At PPX, we spent on average about 1 hour recording a song. Today, I spent at least 12 hours on each song." These unauthorized releases have long constituted a substantial part of his recording catalog, amounting to hundreds of albums. Some of Hendricks's unfinished material was released as the 1970 title The Cry of Love. Although the album reached number 3 in the U.S. and number 2 in the U.K., producers Mitchell and Kramer later complained that they were unable to make use of all the available songs because some tracks were used for 1971's Rainbow Bridge. Still others were issued on 1972's War Heroes. Material from The Cry of Love was re-released in 1997 as First Rays of the New Rising Sun, along with other tracks that Mitchell and Kramer had wanted to include. In 1993, MCA Records delayed a multi-million dollar sale of Hendricks' publishing copyrights because Al Hendricks was unhappy about the arrangement. He acknowledged that he had sold distribution rights to a foreign corporation in 1974, but stated that it did not include copyrights and argued that he had retained veto power of the sale of the catalog. Under a settlement reached in July 1995, Al Hendricks prevailed in his legal battle and regained control of his son's song and image rights. He subsequently licensed the recordings to MCA through the family-run company Experience Hendricks LLC, formed in 1995. In August 2009, Experience Hendricks announced that it had entered a new licensing agreement with Sony Music Entertainment's Legacy Studios division, which would take effect in 2010. Yeah. I gotta say, just offhand, fuck Sony. Fuck them. The hell with Sony Records. That's just my feelings about them. Anyway, tangent done. Legacy and Experience Hendricks launched in the 2010 Jimi Hendrix catalog project, starting with the release of Valleys of Neptune in March of that year. In the months before his death, Hendricks recorded demos for a concept album tentatively titled Black Gold, which are now in the possession of Experience Hendricks LLC. As of 2019, no official release date has been announced. And then there are a lot of people like to discuss his equipment, especially, like, for example, his guitars and amplifiers. Hendrix's Gibson Flying V guitar was something that he played a variety of guitars throughout his career, but the instrument that became most associated with him was the Fender Stratocaster. He acquired his first Stratocaster in 1966 when a girlfriend loaned him enough money to purchase a used one that had been built around 1964. He thereafter used the model prevalently during performances and recordings. In 1967, he described the instrument as the best all-around guitar for the stuff we're doing. He praised its bright treble and deep bass sounds. With few exceptions, Hendrix played right-hand guitars that were turned upside down and restrung for left-hand playing. This had an important effect on the sound of his guitar because the slant of the bridge pickup, his lowest string had a brighter sound while his highest string had a darker sound, which was the opposite of the Stratocaster's intended design. In addition to Stratocasters, Hendrix also used Fender Jazzmasters, Duosonics, two different Gibson Flying Vs, a Gibson Les Paul, three Gibson SGs, a Gretsch Corvette, and a Fender Jaguar. He used a white Gibson SG Custom for his performances on the Dick Cavett Show in September 1969 and a black Gibson Flying V on the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970. During 1965 and 66, while Hendrix was playing backup for soul and R&B acts in the U.S., he used an 85-watt Fender Twin Reverb amplifier. When Chandler brought Hendrix to England in October 1966, he supplied him with 30-watt Burns amps, which Hendrix thought were too small for his needs. After an early London gig when he was unable to use his preferred Fender Twin, he asked about the Marshall amps that he had noticed other groups using. Years earlier, Mitch Mitchell had taken drum lessons from the amp builder, Jim Marshall, and introduced Hendrix to Marshall. At their initial meeting, Hendrix bought four speaker cabinets and three 100-watt super lead amplifiers. He would grow accustomed to using all three in unison. The equipment arrived on October 11, 1966, and the Experience used the new gear during their first tour. Marshall amps were well-suited for Hendrix's needs, and they were paramount in the evolution of his heavily overdriven sound, enabling him to master the use of feedback as a musical effect, creating what author Paul Trinka described as a definitive vocabulary for rock guitar, end quote. Hendrix usually tuned all the amplifiers' control knobs to the maximum level, which became known as the Hendrix setting. During the 4 years prior to his death, he purchased between 50 and 100 Marshall amplifiers. Jim Marshall said that he was the greatest ambassador his company ever had. And as far as effects, one of Hendrix's signature effects was the wah-wah pedal, which he first heard used with an electric guitar in Cream's Tales of Brave Ulysses, released in May 1967. That July, while performing at the Scene Club in New York City, Hendrix met Frank Zappa, whose band, the Mothers of Invention, were performing at the adjacent Garrick Theater. Hendrix was fascinated by Zappa's application of the pedal, and he experimented with one later that evening. He used a wah pedal during the opening to Voodoo Child, Slight Return, creating one of the best-known wah-wah riffs of the classic rock era. He also uses the effect on Up From the Skies, Little Miss Lover, and Still Raining, Still Dreaming. Hendrix used a Dallas Arbiter fuzz face and a Vox wah pedal during recording sessions and performances, but also experimented with other guitar effects. He enjoyed a fruitful long-term collaboration with electronics enthusiast Roger Mayer, who he once called the secret of his sound. Mayer introduced him to the Octavia, an octave doubling effect pedal, in December 1966, and he first recorded with it during the guitar solo to Purple Haze. Hendrix also used the Univibe, designed to stimulate the modulation effects of rotating Leslie speaker. He used the effect during his performances at Woodstock and on the Band of Gypsies track Machine Gun, which prominently uses the Univibe along with an Octavia and a fuzz face. For performances, he plugged his guitar into the wah-wah, which was connected to the fuzz face, then the Univibe, and finally a Marshall amplifier. As far as his musical influences, as an adolescent during the 1950s, Hendrix became interested in rock and roll artists such as Elvis Presley, Little Richard, and Chuck Berry. In 1968, he told Guitar Player magazine that electric blues artists Muddy Waters, Elmore James, and B.B. King inspired him during the beginning of his career. He also cited Eddie Cochran as an early influence. Of Muddy Waters, the first electric guitarist of which Hendrix became aware, he said, "I heard one of his records when I was a little boy, and it scared me to death because I heard all of these sounds." In 1970, he told Rolling Stone that he was a fan of Western swing artist Bob Wills, and while he lived in Nashville, the television show The Grand Ole Opry. Okay, and here's a quote from him. "I don't happen to know much about jazz. I know that most of those cats are playing nothing but blues, though. I know that much." Hendrix on jazz music. Cox stated that during their time serving in the U.S. military, he and Hendrix primarily listened to Southern blues artists such as Jimmy Reed and Albert King. According to Cox, King was a very, very powerful influence. Howlin' Wolf also inspired Hendrix, who performed Wolf's Killing Floor as the opening song of the U.S. debut at the Monterey Pop Festival. The influence of soul artist Curtis Mayfield can be heard in Hendrix's guitar playing, and the influences of Bob Dylan can be heard in Hendrix's songwriting. He was known to play Dylan's records repeatedly, particularly Highway 61 Revisited and Blonde on Blonde. The experience's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame biography states, "Jimi Hendrix was arguably the greatest instrumentalist in the history of rock music. Hendrix expanded the range and vocabulary of the electric guitar into areas no music had ever ventured before. His boundless drive, technical ability, and creative application of such effects as the wah-wah and distortion forever transformed the sound of rock and roll." Musicologist Andy Allador described Hendrix as one of the most creative and influential musicians that ever lived. Music journalist Chuck Phillips wrote, "In a field almost exclusively populated by white musicians, Hendrix served as a role model for a cadre of young black rockers. His achievement was to reclaim title to a musical form pioneered by black innovators like Little Richard and Chuck Berry in the 1950s. Hendrix favored overdriven amplifiers with high volume and gain. He was instrumental in developing the previously undesirable technique of guitar amplifier feedback and helped to popularize use of the wah-wah pedal in mainstream rock. He rejected the standard bar chord fretting technique used by most guitarists in favor of fretting the low sixth string root notes with his thumb. He applied this technique during the beginning bars of Little Wing, which allowed him to sustain the root note of chords while also playing melody. This method has been described as piano style, with the thumb playing what a pianist's left hand would play and the other fingers playing melody as a right hand. Having spent several years fronting a trio, he developed an ability to play rhythm chords and lead lines together, giving the audio impression that more than one guitarist was performing." Which is very similar to what Robert Johnson did. If you listen to the Halloween show that I did about Robert Johnson on the track "Hellhound on My Trail," it almost sounds like two guys are playing, but it's just one guitarist. So there's another parallel with Robert Johnson. It's uncanny. If I was superstitious, I'd probably make something of it, but I'm not going. I'm not superstitious, so I'm not going to. He was the first artist to incorporate stereophonic phasing effects into rock music recordings. Holly George Warren of Rolling Stone wrote, "Hendrix pioneered the use of the instrument as an electronic sound source. Players before him..." I think I've already gone over this. "While creating his unique musical voice and guitar style, Hendrix synthesized diverse genres, including blues, R&B, soul, British rock, American folk music, 1950s rock and roll, and jazz. Musicologist David Moskowitz emphasized the importance of blues music in Hendrix playing his style. And according to authors Stephen Robey and Brad Schreiber, he explored the outer reaches of psychedelic rock. His influence is evident in a variety of popular music formats and has contributed significantly to the development of hard rock, heavy metal, funk, post-punk, grunge, and hip-hop music." That's impressive right there. "His lasting influence on modern guitar players is difficult to overstate. His techniques and delivery have been abundantly imitated by others. Despite his hectic touring schedule and notorious perfectionism, he was a prolific recording artist who left behind numerous unreleased recordings. More than 40 years after his death, Hendrix remains as popular as ever, with annual album sales exceeding that of any year during his lifetime. Hendrix has influenced numerous funk and funk rock artists, including Prince, George Clinton, John Frusciante, formerly of the band Red Hot Chili Peppers, Eddie Hazel of Funkadelic, and Ernie Isley of the Isley Brothers. Grunge guitarists such as Jerry Cantrell of Alice in Chains and Mike McCready and Stone Gossard of Pearl Jam have cited Hendrix as an influence. Hendrix's influence also extends to many hip-hop artists, including De La Soul, A Tribe Called Quest, Digital Underground, Beastie Boys, and Run DMC. Miles Davis was deeply impressed by Hendrix, and he compared Hendrix's improvisational abilities with those of saxophonist John Coltrane. Guitar virtuoso Greg Koch has stated that Jimi Hendrix was his biggest influence. Hendrix also influenced industrial artist Marilyn Manson. Yeah, Marilyn Manson was influenced by Jimi Hendrix. Put it like this, you know how Jimi Hendrix set his guitar on fire, the Monterey Pops, and, you know, he was, like, trying to coax the flames higher with his fingers? Marilyn Manson was known for doing something similar. What he would do is he would take a metal lunchbox, and he'd throw some paper and trash in it, and he'd set that on fire, and he'd coax the flames higher. He'd do that on stage. That was part of his Marilyn Manson stage act. So I bet he got that from Jimi Hendrix. And Hendrix also influenced blues legend Stevie Ray Vaughan, Metallica's Kirk Hammett, Aerosmith's Brad Whitford, Judith Priest's Richie Faulkner, instrumental rock guitarist Joe Satriani, Frank Zappa, David Bowie, Talking Heads, King Crimson, Nine Inch Nails, Hired Gun, Adrian Belew, and heavy metal virtuoso Yngwie Malmsteen, who said, "Hendrix created modern electric playing. Without question, he was the first. He started all. The rest is history." Hendrix has received several prestigious rock music awards during his lifetime and posthumously. In 1967, readers of Melody Maker voted him the Pop Musician of the Year. In 1968, Rolling Stone declared him the Performer of the Year. Also in 68, the city of Seattle gave him the keys to the city. Disc and Music Echo newspaper honored him with the World Top Musician of 1969, and in 1970, Guitar Player magazine named him the Rock Guitarist of the Year. Rolling Stone ranked his three non-posthumous studio albums, Are You Experienced, Access Bold as Love, and Electric Ladyland, among the 500 greatest albums of all time. They ranked Hendrix number one on their list of the 100 greatest guitarists of all time and number six on the list of their 100 greatest artists of all time. Guitar World's readers voted six of Hendrix's solos among the top 100 greatest guitar solos of all time. Purple Haze, The Star-Spangled Banner from Live at Woodstock, Machine Gun, Little Wing, Voodoo Child, and All Along the Watchtower. I love that. I absolutely love that song, All Along the Watchtower. If you've never heard it, I'm going to try and make sure and put it in the Reverb playlist so that you can locate it. Rolling Stone placed seven of his recordings in their list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Purple Haze, All Along the Watchtower, Voodoo Child, Foxy Lady, Hey Joe, Little Wing, and The Wind Cries Mary. By the way, Hey Joe was sort of remade by the band Typo Negative as Hey Peter. So it was pretty much a cover. It's just they changed Hey Joe to Hey Peter because the lead singer of Typo Negative, his name was Peter Steele. So there's that. Maybe I'll put that down on the Reverb playlist too. Let's see, he also got a star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, which was dedicated to him on November 14th, 1991 at 6627 Hollywood Boulevard. The Jimi Hendrix Experience was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1992 and the UK Music Hall of Fame in 2005, as previously stated. In 1999, readers of Rolling Stone and Guitar World ranked Hendrix among the most important musicians of the 20th century. In 2005, his debut album, Are You Experienced, was one of 50 recordings added that year to the United States National Recording Registry in the Library of Congress. Library of Congress, quote, to be preserved for all time. Part of the nation's audio legacy. In Seattle, November 27, 1992, which would have been Hendrix's 50th birthday, was made Jimi Hendrix Day, largely due to the efforts of his boyhood friend, guitarist Sammy Drain. The blue plaque identifying Hendrix's former residence at 23 Brook Street, London, next door to the former residence of George Friedrich Handel, was the first issued by English Heritage to commemorate a pop star. A memorial statue of Hendrix playing a Stratocaster stands near the corner of Broadway and Pine Streets in Seattle. In May 2006, the city renamed a park near its Central District Jimi Hendrix Park in his honor. In 2012, an official historic marker was erected on the site of the July 1970 Second Atlanta International Pop Festival near Byron, Georgia. The marker text reads in part, over 30 musical acts performed, including rock icon Jimi Hendrix, playing to the largest American audience of his career, end quote. His music has received a number of Hall of Fame Grammy Awards, starting with a Lifetime Achievement Award in 1992, followed by two Grammys in 1999 for his albums Are You Experienced and Electric Ladyland. Axis Bold as Love received a Grammy in 2006. In 2000, he received the Hall of Fame Grammy Award for his original composition, Purple Haze, and in 2001 for his recording of Dylan's All Along the Watchtower. Hendrix's rendition of the Star-Spangled Banner was honored with a Grammy in 2009. The United States Postal Service issued a commemorative postage stamp honoring Hendrix in 2014. On August 21, 2016, Hendrix was inducted into the Rhythm and Blues Music Hall of Fame in Dearborn, Michigan. The James Marshall Jimi Hendrix United States Post Office in Renton Highlands near Seattle, about a mile from Hendrix's grave and memorial, was renamed for Hendrix in 2019. Sorry, everybody, my voice is getting tired. I'm going to try and hang on and finish this. On July 23rd, 2019, the Band of Gypsies were inducted into the Hall of Rhythm and Blues Music Hall of Fame at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit, Michigan. Billy Cox, the last surviving member of the group, was on hand to accept, along with representatives of the Buddy Miles and Hendrix estates. And I forgot who said it, but some musical pundit, it was somewhere in my notes, but it got lost. Some musical pundit basically said there's two albums, there's two eras in rock history. There's before Hendrix, and then there's after Jimi Hendrix. And this has been quite a long, long podcast. My voice is getting really tired. I'm having trouble speaking. Sorry for that. It's about time to end. I think I'm going to have a beer, pet a cat, and go to bed. But until then, please support your favorite unsigned artists. A lot of them are having trouble keeping the lights on and food on the table. And you can best help them by listening to their music. And if the music sounds good, spam it all over the internet. And I am out of here. Peace out, Reverb audience. Good night.